are listening to the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Hello, 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 my good people. Cheerio and good tidings to you. No announcements for this evening. I'm just going to keep this thing short and sweet. I will save you all from my yammering and stammering, and we're just going to get right to the good stuff. Our guest tonight, our musician and comic book illustrator, Afua Richardson, and the musical guest is Sophistafunk. Thank you for listening to this broadcast from SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, Marty Leeds, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of these, as well as our books and videos at thesyncbook.com. Our guest tonight is Afua Richardson. Afua Richardson, also known as Dr. Fu, is an American comic book illustrator best known for her work in Top Cow's pilot season-winning comic book, Genius. In addition to being an illustrator with clients including Marvel, Dark Horse, and DC Comics, Afua is a seasoned musician, voice actress, and singer-songwriter. Richardson is the recipient of the Nina Simone Award for Artistic Achievement as one of the few Native African-American female comic book creators working for the largest three publishers of comic books in the world. Afua is a peaceful political activist and mentor and has developed communities of artists, teaching and advising up-and-coming creative professionals on their endeavors. You can find her on Facebook at Dr. Fu's Lab as well as on the web at www.afuarichardson.info. So without further ado, let's get pious with Afua Richardson. Dr. Fu, what's happening? Hey. How are you?
Mr. Marty Leeds, thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah. Thanks for doing this. I'm glad the universe is letting us do this. We tried this about two or three other times, and it just wasn't going to make it happen. So I'm glad we're doing this now. So how are things?
Things are great. I've just been really busy getting ready for a bunch of different projects that I've been working on for a while. So
what do you got?
Good. I'm about to start working on Wonder Woman. It's going to be a digital one-shot for DC Comics, which I'm excited about. Wow. They might actually print it, but I've yet to find that out. I don't want to mislead people.
Oh, that's cool. Very cool. I see the sun shining through your window there. Is it nice out or what?
It is gorgeous today. It must be about 65 degrees here in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, nice. How is Georgia? I've never made it over there. Is it pretty cool in Georgia?
It is. It's all right. It's a very mixed bag. I'm out in Stone Mountain. It's the largest granite outcropping, apparently, on the East Coast.
Oh, really? You and your husband Cameron and Randall and I think the kids from Red Ice, you guys all went up to the Guidestones up there, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, how was that?
It was great. It's sort of an unusual landmark. It's like American Stonehenge out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
There are these very well-crafted, spooky rocks, which I had a strange dream. Not this trip, but the last time I went up there. It was so odd I had to blog it, and strange parts of the dream started coming true. Someone had to remind me. Anyway, yeah.
What do you make of those things?
Well, I used to just dismiss my dreams. I would jot them down and think, wow, that was strange. And then as I started speaking to people, I noticed that many people have dreams that come true in some way. And dreams are just one of those things that we all have and we know are real, but they don't exist anywhere else other than in our heads. And analyzing what's actually happening to us as we dream. We're kind of making our own psychedelic, and we're dosing ourselves in sleep, changing our senses, and who knows what comes in as we change the spectrum of what it is we can actually see. With that particular dream out at the Guidestones, I had a dream that I was actually at the Guidestones, and I was laying down, and I was suddenly standing upright without ever having stood up. And there were three tornadoes swirling around a factory way off in the horizon, and then they exploded into a mushroom cloud, which is pretty intense, a dream to have. when I woke up, because we'd gone up to the Guidestones, it's maybe 2 hours from Atlanta proper, and it's literally out in the middle of nowhere. The town that it's in, it's a couple of miles away from there, and I'm not exactly sure why it's positioned there, but people have a lot of theories. Some theorize that it was made by Freemasons, but the builders wanted to remain anonymous. Go ahead, please.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The strange thing about that dream was that it was maybe a couple of months. And I have to look back because I blogged it, but it was very close to the time when my family was hit in Tuscaloosa by three tornadoes, one of them being a mile wide. And then it was the same year as the Fukushima.
Oh, really?
And yeah, so it was.
So you had this dream prior to all of this stuff happening?
Yes.
Wow. Wow.
And I think that happens to a lot of people, and they just wanted to dismiss it because it can't be measured, or the results can't be repeated or really verified, other than, you know, I blogged it and someone had to remind me, hey, that happened in your dream.
Uh-huh. How prophetic do you think dreams are? How much like of the dream world spills over into what you do?
it spills over quite a bit. I think our minds are these crazy receptors of information, and all these chemicals that are swimming around in our bodies change our perception. And sure, sometimes it's unconscious and subconscious soup just regurgitating the things in the day, and sometimes there are other things that I can't explain. I can't verify, but I know they happen. Like with my husband Cameron, I had a dream that I was sitting next to someone who fits his description, and I drew him. And a couple of years later, I meet Cameron, and we go on a first date, and I take a photo, and I look back in my blog at some of my old drawings, and I'm like, wow, this looks exactly like our second date.
That's right. And you actually showed that on that picture on Facebook, and it's a pretty remarkable resemblance. I mean, it's pretty dead on.
Yeah. It's a little spooky.
So what does that say to you? You know, I mean, you know, when I have those things happen to me, those sort of like weird synchronicities or where dreams spill over into reality, to me, it was like they were, like Karens on the path of, you know, of the right path. And those were sort of Karens that, you know what I mean, if you will, that said, hey, I'm kind of going in the right direction. What do you make of that?
I would agree with that. I think, you know, humans as a species, we like to think that whatever it is we can measure right now is all there is. And then 20 years later, you know, we look back at the previous generations like, wow, I can't believe you thought that. You know, the largest thing was the largest and the smallest the smallest. There are always these new discoveries. So I think if more research was done into the, I guess just the significance of dreams, and the mind in the dream state that we would find, you know, maybe within the nature of space and time, like those considerations would change, especially knowing people have the capability to peer ahead in time in these various ways.
In dreams you have the ability to things like fly, the ability to prophesy, see into the future, mm-hmm. superhuman strength, things like these. These are a lot of things that show up in dreams. They also show up in mythologies, and then they also show up in what you do as well, comic books. Like, is this? Or do you think these are archetypes of the mind, or what draws man's attention to these sorts of things that we see this reoccurring?
There are a lot of artists who have spoken about just that very subject, like Grant Morrison in his book, and I haven't read it in its entirety, but essentially he compares comic book heroes to figures in religious beliefs and as well as in ancient mythologies. So Batman is mm-hmm. Hades, is Pluto. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the function of Pluto, it's the planetoid that's furthest out. It sort of observes all because it surrounds all of the other planets, and it's sort of the ruler of the underworld. It kind of keeps all of these frozen asteroids that are outside of our solar system at bay, mm-hmm. kind of like a bargeman. Nothing can really go past or come through unless it gets disrupted by the gravitational pull of Pluto. And Batman is known to be this very dark, figure, even though he's a hero. Or Superman is often compared to Jesus, and that can be thought of as the sun. He's 33 years old. His father, Kal-El, so loved his only son that he sent him to Earth.
Oh, yeah. Huh. I never even made those correlations. Wow, that's interesting. Okay.
And so, and like Neo being Jesus, just these updates of these ratios being present in these myths, like natural phenomenon being personified. Mm-hmm. Which is why they ring so true. Like, why is Luke Skywalker so popular? Why is Star Wars so popular? Because those ratios are always present. It's calling on these old archetypes that people face, you know, within scale and invariance every day. Mm-hmm. But because it's calling on these old archetypes, it rings true generationally, even if people don't know why.
So do you how much of this within the comic book world anyway, when how much of this is intentional with the storyteller, and if you're and since you're mainly an illustrator, right, you don't do a lot of the writing, right? You're mainly the illustrator.
For now I'm the illustrator. I am going to be working on books of my own where I incorporate a lot of these things. It's just taking me a while.
Yeah. So how much of this is intentional when they write these stories, do you think? And when you illustrate, do you try to bring out these aspects, you know, archetypally, if you will, that we see? I mean, do you try to bring these things out yourself, or do you just try to go to the story and do the best job with the story that you're given?
It depends. I try every time I sit down to the paper to draw these things into being, because I think it's very important, because that's how I'd come across them, you know, looking up these different authors, seeing these symbols repeated, you get these psychological prompts. There's an anime called Neon Genesis Evangelion, and basically it's about these angels that come to Earth and they cause serious destruction. So children have to sit in these giant mech suits and fight these angels. And it incorporates the tree of life. It incorporates catastrophism and all of these other things that I didn't know about when I first saw it. And later on, you see it so prevalent that you're like, okay, this can't be a coincidence. I think people are trying to reach out through the mediums that they have to maintain this information, just as our ancestors did, through stone, through temples, through sacred sites. Those things that last are the stories. So I try my best to do that as well. It's a little bit more difficult when I'm working with someone else's script, mm-hmm. but with a character like Wonder Woman, she's Diana. She's mm-hmm. Athena. So this is something that I can sort of take my time and play around with, just in the way that I can. In one of the scenes, she's sitting at home reading a book before, you know, an enemy breaks into her home. And so behind her, I'm going to have, you know, Demeter, who is also Athena, the goddess of the hunt, as an archer. But her bow will be made out of the moon, because those symbols are multivalent and sort of interchangeable when talking about Diana. And I'm still learning. And as I learn, you know, hopefully I'll get better at it and make things more and more significant. So then people will make the discoveries for themselves. I don't have to spill it out.
So what drew you to, that's a pun, huh? terrible. What drew you to this stuff? I mean, was there an attraction to these superpowers that we see in myth, that and that's why you were drawn to comics, or what's the appeal for you?
Well, I'd loved comics since I was about 9 years old, and it's interesting that the comic that stood out to me the most, or at least the author that stood out to me the most, was Alan Moore, who is a self-proclaimed magician. Mm-hmm. And the comic that he wrote was Swamp Thing, which I didn't understand at all when I was 9, but I was just so drawn to it. And it would be funny that I would be drawing comic books later. But I think what really seriously sent me on the path of looking for the knowledge was an author by the name of Neil Gaiman. And he has a book entitled American Gods, where the premise is basically the belief in a deity increases their strength, and they are manifest in a body depending on their location. So if a large group of people believe in Anansi, in Africa, then the more there's the belief, the stronger this deity's power is. And so once the people of Africa were brought over in the Maifa passage, they brought Anansi with them, so he was born again in another person. Not that he infested a body, but that he just congealed into a new person in the Americas, but he's not as strong. So I thought that was a fascinating idea, and he gets into Odin and the World Tree and just all these things that I'd heard of here and there, but I didn't really start looking into until it was all kind of put together in his books, which is a subject matter that he touches on very often. So I started thinking to myself, okay, well, I want to start drawing some of my own, you know, deities. Well, I thought to myself, well, what if each culture has their alias for a natural phenomenon? And so I started looking, just digging in the crates, and realized I had my work cut out for me. But I started with the moon. I was like, well, every culture has a moon. You know, it's the raven, it's Koye Shakui, it's, you know, in just all of these different representations across the board of what the moon, or who the moon is. Mm-hmm. So I tried my best to consolidate it into one drawing, and thought of putting out a book of a sort of a, like a God alias or a God passport that, you know, when this particular presence is in this town, it's called this. Then I realized that I would be searching forever. And so when I moved to Atlanta, I met Cameron and Cameron Wiltshire of Sacred Geometry International, and he was telling me about Randall Carlson. He said, "You've got to meet this guy. He just happens to be doing a presentation on the moon." I was like, "Well, that's great." And my mind was completely blown. I was like, "Wow, I knew none of that. I don't even know where I would have found any of that." And so I just started going down that rabbit hole and then noticing that the greats, like the Renaissance artists, were incorporating sacred geometry and symbolism. And I started to wonder, were they great because they were incorporating those things, or I actually think they were great because they incorporated those things. Now that I think about it, that the greats incorporated these just divine symmetry and phi and pi within their compositions, mimicking the structure of life, the geometry of life within their art.
And all the masters, without question, did this. Absolutely. I mean, that's pretty well known at this point, though maybe it's only been well known in the last couple of years as far as contemporary society is concerned, right?
Right.
Yeah. So how much sacred geometry, since that occurrence, how much sacred geometry it gets into your work?
As far as my composition, I'm trying. I'm still sort of like at the very beginning stages, because comic book art just takes so much time. But I'm starting to realize that my compositions just sort of come from the geometry. So when I start laying down grids and I'll start setting up perfect rectangles on a page, then start cutting in the diagonals and making geometric shapes within my page layout, the panels that I had in mind just start appearing, and I'm like, man, I'm making this is making my life so much easier. Why haven't I done this sooner? And I guess it was just because I didn't know how. But as I'm learning, you know, as much as I can put in, I will.
Out of the other artists that you've conversed with in that, how many of those people study sacred geometry?
Not many that I know of. I know there's Mike Oeming, who is a well-known comic book artist. One thing that I do notice is that those artists who have really great proportions and compositions, even if it's not intentional, you can sort of draw the overlaying geometry underneath it. Mm-hmm. So even if they don't mean to, their piece works because it's very symmetrical.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about the masters really knowing this information, it seems like at one point they would have, whether it's stumbling on this knowledge or passing on information, at some point, you know, they must have realized that these natural things like phi and pi and things like that were sort of naturally flowing out of them. And then in order to work with this art, it would sort of seem that you were, by working with the art, you were flowing with this creative force. And so therefore it seems that would, as you were saying before, bring out that true, like, divine intelligence, if you will.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you look at, say, an artist like Dali, mm-hmm. he might not be very present in all of his paintings, but if you look at his sketches, you can see, in his doodles especially, you'll see all sorts of Masonic symbolism and sacred geometric symbolism within it, that even if it's not contained within the subject matter, what lied underneath the foundation, or even, you know, his intention going in, it was very, very apparent that that's what he was incorporating.
Mm-hmm. So guys like Salvador Dali, Alan Moore, we could say Walt Disney, whatever you think of these guys, whatever. Obviously, they were, you know, their studies were very focused on the occult. So even going beyond comparative mythology and things like that, how much have you studied the occult?
I'm trying to study as much as I can. As I'm getting into this, I realize how much I don't know. You know, there.
Isn't that the first step of knowledge, though, is admitting that you don't know and how much you don't know, right?
Well, it's great, you know, because as an adult, you get to the point where you think, you know, this is all that there is, and everything else is just survival and essentially getting a retirement home. And
which is the death of the artist, right?
It really is.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is great. It's sort of like being a kid all over again, where you can look at everything differently. Like, man, I didn't even think about this before. Like the way that trees grow, the cycles of the moon, our fingerprints, the way the galaxies are formed. I'm like, wow, I can start seeing the hand of the architect, whatever that is to you, mm-hmm. you know, in everything. And so it makes me reconsider everything. And it's like, and I'll find new information. Like I've been listening to a lot of Manly P. Hall lately, or even on a less cheerful note, Thomas Sheridan, who's been speaking about sociopaths, which is also important. It's like, it's almost like two sides of the same coin, where you look at geometry and these patterns, and you're seeing the patterns and the motions of creation, and you're also seeing the hands of destruction. You're mm-hmm. seeing how people who have no conscience think and how they can manipulate people using logical fallacies or emotional arguments or even food and drugs to change people and veer them away from being their true selves. Mm-hmm. And so it's great for comic book plots as well. Because in studying sociopaths, unfortunately, I have a few in my immediate family. It not only helped me understand, you know, that it wasn't me. It wasn't that I didn't love them enough or something that I did wrong. It was there's really no way to change someone if they are a natural sociopath, maybe a proto-sociopath, but then also understanding their place as well, because in the realm of comics, or even just dealing with a protagonist and antagonist, a hero is really only as good as the villain. Would Superman be Superman if he were just rescuing cats from trees? Mm-hmm. So understanding the thoughts and the evidence of sociopaths in politics, in just fiction, has helped me sort of become a better person, be able to warn other people.
Well, isn't that what comic books kind of at the core of all of them in one respect is the thing of good and evil, is that there is this vicious aspect of reality. And in order to come that, you know, you have to be a superhero, if you will, going beyond, you know, we could say supernatural, but of course, you know, nature in and of itself is super. So really, it's sort of harnessing the most your willpower, if you will, and using that against these forces of evil.
Absolutely. And one thing that I really appreciate about the evolution of comics is that they're no longer just 100% good and 100% bad guys. Mm-hmm. Just like in life, those lines are very blurry. Mm-hmm. And sort of showing the full spectrum of what humanity is capable of can enable people to make choices. So it's like, yeah, you may have made a lot of mistakes early in your life, and you may think, all right, well, I come from this place and there's no way I can get out of it. But sometimes reading a work of fiction where you live vicariously through this character for a moment, you're accepting the reality of this fiction, you kind of start to rewrite your own story and become the author of your own tale and think to yourself, well, you know, I see myself in this, I see myself in this villain, and I see that my life can be another way if I choose to write it that way.
Mm-hmm. How much, in one sense, it's like you can identify with the protagonist, you can identify with the hero, or I suppose you can identify with the antagonist as well, but how much of this is, when we see kids being drawn to comic books, how much of it do you think is an escape, you know, to escape the world that we live in, and how much do you feel like it's to identify with a character that can therefore triumph in his in the co-authoring of his own story, if you will?
I think it's really up to the individual, because a lot of times people will maintain cognitive dissonance. And on one hand, they'll be Superman fans, and they're like, "Yeah, you have to see the good in people, no matter what. You should save them, even if they're a villain." And yet, they support the war on terror, mm-hmm. without questioning 9/11, without questioning, you know, these official stories that governments have sold us for the last, you know, however many hundred years, that there's a bad guy somewhere that we need them to protect us from. Mm-hmm. You know, and so seeing that, unfortunately, it happens quite a bit, because some people identify more with fictional characters than they do others, because they've just been hurt and let down so much that, you know, this fictional character won't let them down. And I try my best to navigate through those fields, especially at comic conventions where I interface with a lot of my fans, or just other comic appreciators who've never met me, but we, you know, they'll see my work and then they'll want to have a conversation about a character, which is funny. It's kind of like having a mutual friend who'll have a conversation about Wolverine as if he's an old roommate or something. Mm-hmm. Like, Wolverine wouldn't do that. It's like, really? All right. He's not real, but let's have this conversation. But then it can be a tool, because I can explain a concept that has been explained in a work of fiction and then compare it to real life when some people want to, you know, veer away from reality and just fall into fiction. And they'll sometimes accept fiction as truth without question. And I'm trying my best to sort of enable comic fans to think logically, because I know a lot of them have been dejected and let down, and I let them know, hey, I have totally been where you are, but it doesn't have to be all about this. You can be a hero too. Like, you can think logically, you can believe in God and science, and it doesn't have to be this bearded man who will smite you for not listening to or who doesn't listen to your secret whispers if you don't say the right name. You know, it's it can be something more than that, and I think comics are a really great tool to bridge that gap.
You were just mentioning that, like, a lot of your fans or whatever, the hardships. What kind of hardships have you undergone in your life to you know, to inform you to make the right decisions to get where you are?
Well, as I'd mentioned before, one of my family members was a sociopath, and it took a while to figure that out, but they sort of broke our family apart. So when I was 16, 17, I didn't have a place to stay. You know, one of my parents had to leave to escape them, and there wasn't much for the family to do but try and stay afloat, and so I just ended up couch hopping from place to place, which is really difficult in New York City. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I slept on the subway because where I was staying was just not okay, and that put me in a lot of danger. And I ended up, you know, getting attacked and having a fight and losing teeth. And it just, you know, I laugh about it because it's like, man,
now you have some time.
Now that I have time away from it. it's like, wow, that's kind of insane. But I wouldn't change a thing, because I can put that energy into the work, and then I can tell others who are aspiring artists not just how to draw, but how to overcome their circumstances by changing their mind. Because a lot of times, you know, situations like that, people get locked in mentally thinking, oh, well, I'm homeless, and so therefore I'm a hobo, and there's nothing that I can do to escape that. Or, you know, happiness isn't meant for someone like me. And that's something that I've heard quite a bit from comic artists, or, oh, you know, or not comic artists, but comic appreciators, or there are a lot of issues with weight and body image, which occurs, you know, quite a bit. And there, I've noticed a connection between abuse and obesity, that people will sometimes create a distance between people by putting on excess weight. It's like an emotional barrier that manifests itself physically.
Mm-hmm. So throughout this course of, you know, going through these hardships and stuff like that, how many times did you just want to be like, all right, I give up, I'm done?
how many times?
Yeah, right? So what?
Monthly?
Yeah. So what kept you going?
Art and music, really. My friends, I had some really, really amazing friends who were also artists, and they would encourage me. And, you know, I would kind of go back and forth between, you know, I'm not meant to be happy, and I'm just doomed to live a life like this. And then it would kind of go the other way, where it was like, well, you know, there's no, I've yet to see a story where a great accomplishment wasn't met with great difficulty. And to make it, it's going to sound a little corny, but it's almost like a video game. You know, you're not going to advance unless the monsters get harder. You're not going to win the sword or the castle or the princess or the experience points unless you fight the dragon and you start upping the level.
It might seem cheesy, but it's almost a perfect analogy, isn't it? You know, the journey to the center is a long and arduous, tough journey, but
right,
it must be done. And in order to get to those next levels, you have to overcome those dragons, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it's funny that you'd say dragons, and I associate dragons with the spine.
Yes, of course. Yeah. So, I mean, how so obviously creativity helped you get past all of those things. How important do you feel, like, to me, I see as in a psychological development and a spiritual development, I see creativity as one of the most important things. Where do you shake out with that?
I would definitely agree with you there. I think, unfortunately, people have been separated. They are told that if they're left brain, that they can't be creative, that, you know, athletes can't be philosophers, or, you know, scientists can't be warriors. And hopefully those gaps will start bridging. And especially, you know, looking at things like the trivium and the quadrivium, seeing that math being present in music, geometry, astronomy, just all across the board, that creativity enabling someone to learn math musically, mm-hmm, is critical, because everyone learns differently. And public school, which I unfortunately went to, sort of forces everyone to learn the same way. And if they don't, you know, they get tossed into, you know, some subpar class. But I feel that art and music make someone more whole, as well as learning, you know, the maths and sciences, which I'm working on.
So you tackle a bunch of different mediums. You're right. I mean, you do illustration, singing, songwriting, things like that. Mm-hmm. Where does that creative spark come from? And before before we got on the air, you were talking about, hey, I was up at 7 a.m. because I was sitting there, and all of a sudden the flash of the image came in your head about what you needed to write, and it came at 7 a.m, and that means you had to stay up and get the shit done. Where does that come from? Where does it come from for you?
Different things. Sometimes it comes through music. Sometimes it comes through nature, just taking a walk and clearing my mind. If I sit too stagnant, if I just sit in front of the computer and try to come up with something, the energy doesn't really flow.
It never works.
Yeah, it really doesn't. Yeah. So I have to kind of give to myself in order to give to the work, to kind of get my mind jogging and start pulling in other wellsprings of information. I'll read a book. I'll, go for a run. Just get kinetic thoughts happening.
It seems like when you go out and learn more, when you go out and seek out knowledge, mm-hmm. right? Whether that knowledge is, and there's no really bad knowledge. There's only just knowledge, and of course, right? When you seek out that knowledge, to me, the creative juices start flowing, right?
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's like, as you were saying, you give what you get. You have to put in that seeking out of knowledge. You have to go get the inspiration for anything to come. Like I always say, if you're if you want to be a writer, you have to read a lot. If you want to be a musician, you have to listen to a lot of music. You have to challenge your ear. And yes. I think that in order for an artist to keep going, I'm gonna get your take on this, is that when the attainment of that knowledge that brings on the creativity also brings on that wonderment, that spark that you have when you're a child to see everything as almost new again. And that's the feeling that I get. And it's usually just that idea, that spark, that whatever, that scintilla that ends up, lighting the fire of whatever creative output I'm doing. Does that make any sense?
No, it absolutely does. I think if you imagine knowledge kind of like a blank sheet of paper, when you start to innovate and take in more information into your mind's repertoire and in your reservoir, you start to make comparisons, like folding the paper. You're folding this paper up and you're starting to see other sides of the same sheet of paper, but you're seeing different angles. You're seeing different formations. Lines are drawn together where you wouldn't normally have drawn conclusions because the knowledge hasn't started creating those folds. And that's what I feel ends up happening. I'll read something and it'll spark something else. I'll start, I was trying to think of an example. I'm working on a book called Aquarius, The Book of Mer, and it's going to be about mermaids. And I started listening to Manly P. Hall talk about Atlantis. And
it's funny, I'm listening to that lecture series right now.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, it's funny.
It's a great one.
It is. It's really good, yeah.
Yeah, and he, at one point, he starts talking about the accounts of Quetzalcoatl and, or even some countries, he refers to them as primitive, but, just not in a negative sense, but just folks who had a simple life. If they had, say, encountered someone who was from, theorized Atlantis, say they had scuba gear and they came out of the water, what would someone who'd never seen any kind of technology like that, what would they call it? How would they describe it? They might describe it as a man with a fish head or fish body mm-hmm. that came from the water, gave us a bunch of knowledge, and then returned to the water and said that he would come back one day. And then, maybe a catastrophe happened and where Atlantis was on a fault line and they weren't able to come back. Mm-hmm. Manatees being confused as women. they're strangely, as I've been looking for this, all of these accounts of mermaid encounters, and not that I really believe in mermaids per se, but perhaps under the influence of psychedelics, people will see themselves or basically inducing a waking dream, bringing it back to dreams, they will see themselves as half animal and flying.
Which of those archetypes spilling over again, really?
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the Mi'kmaq Indians in Canada, they have an account of the small half child, half fish, and a colonialist was with him with a fisherman, and they found this child fish and they threw him back into the water. And who knows if that's true? Who knows if it's a metaphor? Who knows if it's someone ingested some mushrooms and saw something else? Mm-hmm. Or it could be all of them at the same time. It's great to start making these folds in the paper and thinking about the different connections within our universe, because we're only really here for a short time, and to think that we have anything figured out is really just, it's just really short-sighted. So I love being a part of comics, because it sort of pushes the envelope as far as the imagination, because they're not anchored by terminal reality. Like, oh, well, that will never happen, so I'm not even going to imagine it. And then you see it start to change reality. Like, I think there's a people are looking into teleportation because of shows like Star Wars and Star Trek. Well, Star Trek, let me get my geek-isms right before somebody skewers me. There's no teleportation in Star Wars.
How much do you see as one thing when I looked at like science fiction? It seems like when we look at the science fiction, like the 40s and 50s, a lot of that stuff that they were talking about, like, well, not teleportation, but things like stuff like if you look at you remember Ziggy, you remember that from Quantum Leap? It's like almost like a fucking iPhone now. Yeah. It's almost like science fiction. This sort of stuff is foreshadowing things that are going to happen in the future, and this kind of gets back to that archetype of prophecy again, if you know what I'm saying. Like, how much do you feel like art in and of itself is foreshadowing the future?
It may not be intentional, but I think artists allowing themselves to think beyond what we know to be true.
Wrong.
Yeah. And then people fulfill that prophecy. They're like, well, why can't we do that? How? Let's start thinking about how that would be possible. And they start connecting those lines.
That's exactly what I was thinking about, is the idea is that, okay, so how much of this is subconscious that we're bringing out, that we are sort of telling the future with art, and how much of it is up to, well, I mean, obviously it's up to us because we have free will, but when we look at, hey, we're going to bring out Terminator 2, that this is going to be foreshadowing what's going to happen, but we could also bring out, a story about, an Avatar story or something like that, where everybody kind of lives in some sort of quote-unquote quasi-utopia, if you will.
I think there was this old song lyric that said, dreams are the life you lead, and if you start looking in a particular direction, especially if you have those prompts from fiction to look in that direction, mm-hmm. then I think not only are artists calling things into being, but they're sort of calling out to those who might not be able to now, but in the future be able to manifest what it is that they've envisioned. Mm-hmm. Like the gentleman who discovered the DNA helix did so under the influence of LSD.
Yeah, I believe that's the story anyway, yeah.
And I don't know how I'd be able to verify that, but sometimes I think the vision comes first and then proving the theorem comes later. So artists are sort of presenting the theory without the scientific exploration behind it. Mm-hmm. Or they sort of start the prompt for others who can.
So when you I'll give you what happens to me anyway. Like when I go to write a song, mm-hmm. there's a flash of inspiration and I get that flash, and it's almost like that song is complete in and of itself. And I'm only going to dictate from the ether, the other, whatever, the invisible landscape, that thing out of its already inherent being in the subconscious or whatever. When you had a flash the other night and like, I've got the image, I got to go write it down. Does that come to you almost like fully formed and you're just sort of like fleshing the thing out? You're sort of dictating it out, if you will? Because that's how I feel creative sparks really come. You have to go fishing for it. You have to, all the intricacies of it, all the lines you're drawing, all the colors, et cetera, the verse, the chorus, whatever. But you're sort of bringing that down. Do you see it that way?
No, I absolutely feel the same way. I feel like a vessel for the work, that it already exists somewhere and it chooses me to bring it into being. And all the sketching lines, all of the drafting, all of the geometry are just making it easier for me to see what already exists in my head that, you know, kind of floated in there. And I do my best to bring it down. You know, I have to use my left brain, like, okay, so how can I do this? And sometimes it'll be a little spooky, the synchronicities that occur when I do that. Like, I just wrote a song. I'm in a band called Waking Astronomer, and I just wrote a song called Brer Rabbit. And Brer Rabbit is a name for a rabbit trickster, and in addition to that, there's Mercury, there's the coyote, there's the raven who stole the moon, and I've just been singing the words over and over again, and I found this really cool mask for a performance, and it kind of looked like a rabbit, but it was a cat mask. And I wore it at the last show that I had. It was the first time I performed the song. It went over really well. I had a really great time. And that was maybe 2 weeks ago. And I met with my bandmates, you know, 2 days ago, saying, yeah, let's make a video for Brer Rabbit. And the next day, I'm sitting on the floor of my living room putting some furniture together, and I see my cat running across the street with something in his mouth, and I thought it was a mouse, and he was bringing it towards us. Like, great, another dead animal as a present. Thanks, cat. But it was actually a rabbit, and we're nursing him back to health. But so I wore a cat mask singing about a rabbit, and my cat brings a rabbit in his mouth. So, hey, you know, I think we can be vessels for what's to come all the time. It's whether or not you choose to develop your motor skills to be able to make it happen quickly.
That's exactly what I was going to... Yeah, I was going to get to is that the skill set, the development of your mind is sort of, you know, merging the left and right hemispheres of your brain, if you will, to receive these things, see these things, see these synchronicities play out. Because chances are things like that, like I wore a cat mask and, you know, my cat brought a rabbit, things like that, like little weird things like that seem to be happening to people all the time, but it's only with the development of your mind, and I would say that's a creative mind that allows you to see these things, and therefore allows you to, well, unearth that wonder that we're talking about.
Absolutely, and I think unfortunately it's dismissed by a lot of people. But you know, if you just allow yourself to think magically a little bit, you can still think logically. You can still, you know, be grounded in reality and think of these crazy invisible strings that are pulling things together. It doesn't have to be all fluff and new age. It can be, you know, grounded in reality, just with the understanding that we don't know how all of this works. But if you continue to push your analytical and creative mind, you're kind of tapping into creativity. You're tapping into the patterns of life. Mm-hmm. So you're sort of playing in key. And sometimes you'll play a note, sort of like the thought of what comes to mind. When you play a string on a violin, a violin that's sitting next to it will start to vibrate the same way. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of similar to that, where, you know, either the artist is receptive to what is there, or the artist brings about a new reality by making themselves available.
Mm-hmm. To receive that new reality. Right. And therefore and bring it out.
Broadcast it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, you're in we only got about 5 minutes left here. You're in Waking Astronomer. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, it's a trio. I am the singer, flute player, and beatbox artist. I don't know how you conjugate that. And it's sort of a super group of solo artists, the piano player, Alexa Lima, who's an amazing graduate of Berklee School of Music, and a producer and percussionist named Deku. And our name sort of came arbitrarily from a bunch of pieces of paper. And anytime someone asks where our name came from, we always say something different. But that is actually the truth. We put in our favorite words, and Waking Astronomer came from the hat. And I said, well, you know, it's interesting because in learning all of this, learning all this information, I feel like I am a awakening astronomer. Mm-hmm. So it's been fun creating music with them and sort of creating songs like Br'er Rabbit, where I take this knowledge and try to put it into lyric and melody as best I can, because music to me is really important. The muse is really important. It sort of becomes a mantra for your life. And if you fill your mantra with like negative and kind of poisonous and just toxic music, then your thoughts will start to dictate the same thing. And not to say that if you just listen to happy, fluffy music that everything's going to be okay. But there is something to making music that is, you know, self-deprecating or damaging to another human being. So I like to be as responsible as I can with, you know, putting, you know, the best music that I can, but also like music of nourishment out mm-hmm. there
mm-hmm.
Something to make people ask questions and.
Yeah, and that's gratifying to you. You're not doing yes. it for somebody else. When you see like the pop culture, the pop charts, it's just like those are people that are writing songs for masses of people to, you know, I don't really see much genuine there, you know.
No, they're products, and I had sort of gone through that portion of the industry before I did comics. You know, I was a professional singer full time, and I thought, well, if I want to be a professional singer, I have to go through those channels. And I just, I'd been offered deals and like, oh, you can be the next Rihanna, you can be the next Monica. And I was like, they're great. They are just fine with singing other people's music, and there's nothing wrong with that. Some people are singers and they're great entertainers, but I just have something different to say. And a lot of times, unfortunately, in the industry, if you don't make your own music, they'll make it for you. Mm-hmm. And they want you to say whatever it is they want you to say.
Yeah.
And I'm not really about that.
I was, you know, when I was younger, I always wanted to be a musician. And then I got out. I got a long, hard look at the music industry, though.
Right.
And that was such a turnoff because of exactly what you said. It's just, you know, it's just pumping out garbage. And not only that, but it seems like, you know, when you get a record contract, it's really just sort of a bank that gives you money at a huge interest rate. And then with all of these, you know, terrible terms in your contract and whatnot. So that really turned me off. What's the comic book industry like? And have you had a difficult time making a living doing it?
The good thing about the music industry now is that you can just put your music out online mm-hmm. and people can find it. With comics, it's a little bit more difficult because it's incredibly competitive. Mm-hmm. But fortunately for me, I'm really stubborn and I'm really persistent. So I've been building community online for a very long time. You know, I'm a self-taught artist. And I didn't have the opportunity to go to school, but I just wanted really badly to learn. And my dad, who is a physicist, one thing he taught me very well was how to learn. So I put myself out there and I started creating something every day. I built myself a terrible little website and just started putting my word out to as many people as possible, asking advice, asking for just whatever critique they could, good or bad. Not everyone's going to know exactly what you can do to be better. People will throw their, you know, opinions around, but if you can take the good with the bad and see what consistently comes up as far as critique, then you can start tweaking your work and then learning from the greats. And then once you figure out what it is that the style that you want, like once you learn the basics, just like with anything, you can start to innovate. Then you start to see how you can be of service. And the reason that I say that is a lot of artists fail in a regard because they just sort of put out their work. And sure, it's good to put out work for you, but what are you really giving? You know, when you, as artists, we're sort of taught to just create emotionally and not think like a business. Mm-hmm. So what I had to think, okay, what do I provide? What will I give in my work? And I'm still defining that. I don't think that's something that I had figured out. And then like, all right, I figured out my figured out my purpose in life, and now I'm going to go and do it. You know, that's always changing. But mm-hmm. I realized that there's not a lot of there wasn't a lot of information or not a lot of one-on-one interaction between aspiring artist and professional artist. And so I started a group on Facebook called Dr. Fu's Lab, where I try to tell and share and inform, you know, other creatives as much as possible. Some of the pitfalls, some of the triumphs, you know, just some of the things that worked for me, because that's how I learned. Not only just looking online and looking in books and asking, but, you know, going up to other professionals and saying, okay, show me the business, like let me know. And I couldn't steal up all of their time, but you know, in a community we can spread more information that way. So that's sort of how I felt that I could be of service, and it's been amazing. You know, like I have some really, really great fans, and they're really appreciative that I'm willing to share what it is that I've learned, because I want people to be able to express themselves. I want people to be able to get their inner thoughts and their inner ambitions out. Because I think people can be better human beings when they have more outlets in which to get that inner mind noise out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm glad you're doing it too, because it's necessary, because I didn't have that when I was growing up, about somebody telling me, you know, teaching me how to express myself necessarily. Was, and I think that now, especially with the internet, we're getting a lot more of that. So it's really cool that you're doing that. So do you want to tell people how to get a hold of you, how to check out your work, how to check out your band, all of that?
Absolutely. You can see my work at afuarichardson.com. That's AFUA. Richardson.com. I'm also on Facebook at facebook.com/Afua, A-F-U-A, Nyoki, N-J-O-K-I, Richardson. That's my fan page. I'm on Tumblr, Dr. Fu, D-O-C-T-A, F-O-O, Fu. That's a nickname that someone gave me because I'm always providing art cures. So Dr. Fu at tumblr.com, and Dr. Fu is also my my Instagram handle, and I'm on Twitter at Afua Richardson, one word.
Sweet and cool. Thanks for doing this. This has been a lot of fun. I'm glad we finally got to connect. So
oh wait, there's also wakingastronomer.com.
Oh, Waking Astronomer.
So many. Forgot.
Don't forget the band, right? Well, cool. Yeah, thanks for doing this, and good luck to you in the future and all that. And hopefully I'll get to meet you in person. It sounds like something in the future is going to happen with Sacred Geometry something. So, yeah, it'll be good.
Sounds like a plan. We'll make some Kabbalah comics. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it. Cool. Say hi to Cameron, and we'll talk to you soon.
Alrighty.
All right. Bye. Thank you. Thanks for listening, everybody. Our outro song is entitled Back to You and is provided by the funk soul groove outfit Sophista Funk. This song is off their record entitled Freedom Is, and I can't stop listening to this song ever since I downloaded it. Super funky and really positive, uplifting lyrics. This band has 2 full-length records and 1 EP, and you can download them on iTunes as well as on their site, SophistaFunkBand.com. Sophista Funk is currently touring all over the United States, so go check them out. Coming up in the next few episodes of the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, we will be speaking with the producer of the documentary The Pyramid Code, Dr. Carmen Bolter, activist and administrator for Sacred Geometry International, Cameron Wiltshire, and we will also be checking back with Laird Scranton about his new book, Looking into the Archaeological Phenomenon of Göbekli Tepe. Make sure to stay tuned and always remember, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks.
Worth more than the money you make. Figure it out before it's too late, and your fears come true. another day. You can hide your face, try to find a secret hiding place. You can even get rebellious, give it all or just be selfish. No matter what you do, in the end, it all comes back to you.
You've been listening to the Marty Leeds Mathemagical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com. And be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.